07-3766 and 15-4308, Audrey Jones versus Margaret Bradshaw. Oral argument, 30 minutes per side. Ms. Bailey for the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Catherine Bailey and I represent Mr. Akbar. Thank you for having me back today. Today I plan to focus on habeas ground 24, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim for presenting harmful expert testimony. I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, please. That's a change from what I had forecasted.
So first, certainly.
Thank you. At Mr. Akbar's penalty phase, Ohio's prosecutor, the lawyer it supplied, and the psychologist it appointed each told an all-white jury over and over again that Mr. Akbar was more likely to be chronically and clinically dangerous because he is Black. In Rose v. Mitchell, Justice Blackmun wrote that discrimination on account of race in the administration of justice strikes at the core concerns of the 14th Amendment and at fundamental values of our society and our legal system. In the capital sentencing context, the Supreme Court tells us that two other things are certain about racial discrimination. First, from Zamp v. Stevens and Buck v. Davis, we know that evidence that links a defendant's race to dangerousness and deathworthiness is unconstitutional, period. Second, from Turner v. Murray, we know that capital sentencing hearings present a unique opportunity for racial prejudice to operate undetected, and that there is an especially serious risk that fear of Black defendants, which can easily be stirred up by the violent facts of an interracial crime, might incline a juror to favor the death penalty. The court vacated the death sentence in Turner, even though four of those jurors were Black. I've noted that all 12 of Mr. Akbar's jurors were white, but more importantly, only two were asked a single question about race during voir dire. These jury issues are not before the court, but the context is critical to recognizing the unacceptable risk of prejudice that resulted from the expert testimony and trial counsel's arguments. Because this evidence was patently unconstitutional, and because Mr. Akbar has established cause to excuse any default, this court must vacate the death sentence. I have a few additional comments on the merits. First is that at the first argument in this case, the warden was asked directly how the evidence here differed from the racialized evidence in Buck. The only credible answer is that it does not. There's no difference between arguing that a man is more likely to be dangerous because he is Black and saying that a man is more clinically diagnosable as a future danger because he is Black. If anything, the formal psychiatric diagnosis makes this type of toxin even more deadly and even more weighty. Dr. Eisenberg, a clinical psychologist, told a racially homogenous jury that only 1% of us are psychopaths, unless you just control for skin color. And then that number skyrockets to 30% for Black men. Just like Dr. Quijano, he testified that an immutable characteristic carried with it an increased probability for future violence. As the court wrote in Buck, here was hard statistical evidence from an expert to guide an otherwise speculative inquiry. Further, in Buck, Dr. Quijano actually told the jury, don't worry, Mr. Buck won't be dangerous in the future. The court still found prejudice. Here, Dr. Eisenberg assured the jury over and over again that Mr. Akbar would continue to be dangerous in the future. His condition was chronic, and when specifically pressed, he refused to opine that his dangerousness would ever cease. Dr. Eisenberg's response to the prosecutor alone establishes prejudice under Buck. But the warden's response doesn't account for anything else in the trial testimony, which is dripping with these linkings. I'd like to give the court a few examples. In counsel's opening, he expressly links young Black men to anger, aggression, and prison. He tells the jury that Mr. Akbar was born into a culture of violence. And then he describes his cultural expert, Mr. C, who's mainly in the Cuyahoga County area, but not exclusively, quote, works with young, particularly Black males, angry, coming out of prison, mad at the world, not sure why and how he deals with those people. He then has Charles C. tell the jury what the worldview of the African-American youths are. And Mr. C. doesn't hesitate to say, well, it's survival by any means necessary. He then cites extreme gang loyalty and the underworld culture that is pervasive, quote, in those communities. Mr. C. then unequivocally confirmed for the jury that Mr. Akbar fits this pattern. Underworld means crime. It means violence.
I think we want to make sure that you use your time effectively, and you may want to get back to the merits issue, but could you address the procedural default issue before we run out of time?
Certainly, Your Honor. The most efficient way for this court to set aside the procedural default of ground 24 found by the district court is to follow what this court did in Greer v. Mitchell and Henderson v. Palmer and apply a straightforward application of Coleman v. Thompson. If you look at the building blocks of this claim, trial counsel was clearly ineffective for presenting this testimony. Because no competent counsel would ever make these arguments, the claim can be resolved on the face of the trial transcript. Direct appeal counsel should have raised this claim, but he failed to do so. However, Mr. Akbar filed a timely application to reopen the direct appeal under Ohio Rule 26B, and he properly and fully exhausted the layered claim. His application included a claim that his direct appeal counsel was ineffective for failing to raise trial counsel's ineffectiveness, quote, for presenting conflicting and prejudicial expert testimony that severely undercut Mr. Akbar's mitigation. We know from Joseph B. Coyle and Davey B. Mitchell that even though these claims are analytically distinct, he met the general requirement for exhaustion, and the underlying claim is preserved, and the default can be set aside.
Hey, counsel, one of the problems I have is that this is an appeal from the denial of the habeas ground 24 from the district court. And ground 24 alleged ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and that you've argued the merits of that. But was ineffective assistance of appellate counsel raised in the district court in this proceedings as a grounds to excuse the procedural default?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
Okay, then how is it before us?
The cause argument is before us, but I would like to make a few points about that. So it is fully exhausted in front of the state courts of Ohio.
Okay, I agree with that.
For purposes of Coleman, it satisfies
okay,
that.
But I'm looking at the district court, and it actually has to be, I think it's your duty once the state raises the issue of procedural default, you have to go to district court and tell the district court why it is not procedurally defaulted. And here, res judicata was argued and Martinez was argued, but ineffective assistance of appellate counsel was not argued in the federal district court. And therefore, I don't see it before us. That's all.
I understand, Judge Griffin. I've addressed this in my reply at length, but I would like to present some more case law for your review. This court addresses the issue of procedural default de novo. It is itself a federal question, and it is, at all times, Mr. Akbar has challenged this default. This isn't a matter of diligence. That the res judicata application was challenged in the first instance does not preclude other meritorious cause arguments to be presented on appeal. No case cited by the warden actually deals with habeas. It doesn't deal with the issue of procedural default, and it doesn't deal with this situation. I would direct the court to Nasiri versus Mackey, which is not mentioned in my reply. That site is 967 F3rd 544. That deals with a procedural ruling below, and there the Court of Appeals did not hold the petitioner to the arguments made by his counsel for a variety of reasons, and one of which was a conflict. I've pointed out in my briefing that the only counsel that was appointed to prepare the traverse in district court was later dismissed by this court after Mr. Akbar pointed out that he suffered from a conflict of interest. The equity concerns there are palpable, especially when you look at Holland v. Florida. The Siri itself talks about this court's ability to reach cause, even if that argument is not presented below. Unlike Nasiri, the cause argument here is plain on the face of the record. I would also point out that this court in Maupin used sequential language. It presumes that a petitioner will have a chance to show cause once the finding of default is made, not simply after it is alleged. In Jacobs v. Moore, in Van Hook v. Bobby, and in Thompson v. Bell, this court undertook cause analyses by looking at the appellate briefs and not getting hung up on the fact that a specific challenge, even in Jacobs, I think there wasn't a challenge at all to the default in front of the district court.
Ms. Bailey, you argue that, switch gears just a little bit maybe, you argue that the Ohio Court of Appeals improperly applied res judicata here. And just want to get your thoughts on what new information was presented in his post-conviction petition. I know there's the Dr. Turner affidavit where he disagrees with Dr. Eisenberg's diagnosis and has a different diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, I think. But I know there's some other affidavits and information. So could you address that?
The affidavits in support of the claim in the post-conviction petition. I mean, I think what's important for the court to recognize is that the claim presented in post-conviction was almost like a kitchen sink attack against counsel's use of Dr. Eisenberg and the experts, in that his coordination, that their testimony conflicted, Dr. Kenny, the neuropsychologist. I mean, there's tension on the record, even in front of the jury, about their conclusions, particularly about antisocial personality disorder. So those affidavits that were produced in post-conviction got to that dynamic in the trial team. Mr. Akbar himself produced an affidavit saying, I didn't get along with this psychologist. I didn't trust him. You know, he threw away my testing results as invalid, called me manipulative and antisocial, but we did not communicate well. And I told my trial lawyer that I didn't like the guy. Dr. Kenny said there was no coordination. He didn't get Dr. Eisenberg's report. He told counsel in advance of the penalty phase that he disagreed. All of this evidence is dehors the record. On top of that, Dr. Turner rendered a new evaluation and examined the evidence. And he reached diagnoses that were more in tune with those of Dr. Kenny and took away the power of this really harmful antisocial personality disorder as the crux of Dr. Eisenberg's testimony. So, you know, whether or not that rendered an evidentiary hearing is one thing, it was certainly enough to overcome the bar. But I'd like to point out that
your point is that the combination of Jones, Kenny, and Turner, each of them had evidence to whore the record. Is that what you're saying? That there were things that made it incorrect for the Court of Appeals of Ohio to say that this was just based on trial evidence?
Yes, and I'll point out the cases mentioned in my appellant's brief that were not addressed by the warden, where similar circumstances, where you have a new psychologist entering in post-conviction, a new opinion, new diagnoses, that enough takes you over that to horse.
But counsel, isn't that a new diagnosis based upon the evidence that was in the trial record? And it's my understanding Ohio has a very broad res judicata rule, that it includes issues that are raised or issues that could have been raised. And therefore, I think you have to determine that there's matters that are not in the record that could not have been raised to overcome the res judicata. Isn't that, rather than just look at the record and come to a different interpretation as to what experts would do, you have to actually have something new, something that wasn't there.
Well, he was newly evaluated, and I think that's the newness that I'm.
But isn't it just evaluation based upon the existing record? And isn't that what's improper?
No, I believe that he met with Mr. Akbar.
So somewhere I got the sense that Turner did meet with Akbar after during this post-conviction phase, and that Turner did new tests on Akbar. Is that correct? And that then those tests were reported in the affidavit?
Yes, it was essentially a new expert report, as if
based on new interpretation, new evidence, not just things that existed at the time of the trial.
No, Your Honor, there was no way to reinterpret data from Dr. Eisenberg because he said his data was invalid. He threw out the MMPI. He said that he manipulated the results and therefore he's antisocial. So it's not a repackaging. I also would like to get to the adequacy of
getting back to Judge Moore's question. The new testing was not in the existing record. So that is outside the record.
Yes. I'm sorry if I was unclear. Yes.
I mean, that may be your best argument, that it's not a repackaging of what's already there. It's something brand new that had not been done before.
Right. Interpreting DeHoor's the record as an applicant is tricky because if it's outside of the record, going back to your point, Judge Griffin, that I understand the broad application of this, but I would also submit that's a very confusing and inconsistent application, that a petitioner himself can submit an affidavit talking about what happened in the context of privilege between him and trial counsel. It's not intuitive, even under Ohio law, that veil between counsel can be pierced on direct appeal, which is supposed to be hinting at what's available in the record that remits to the Supreme Court.
What cases, I'm sorry, go ahead and complete your thought. What cases would most support your position? Would that be Greer and Hill from our circuit? Because we've also got some cases that may go slightly in the other direction, perhaps distinguishable. But what do you think is most supportive of your argument here, case-wise, for race judicata?
The cases that I cited in my opening brief, just a minute, please.
I know you cite Greer and you cite Hill.
Yes, Hartman v. Bagley, White v. Mitchell, Schweiderman v. Smith, that affirming that for an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, it is necessary to know what the uncalled expert would have concluded. That's precisely what Dr. Turner was submitting. Franklin v. Jenkins, if a post-conviction claim would be a new psychologist affidavit and affidavits from trial defense team, as unlike the direct appeal claim, which relied wholly on evidence in the record.
So on this prong of a way of getting around procedural default, do we get to make a de novo determination of whether the doctrine under Ohio law of res judicata was improperly applied by the Ohio Court of Appeals? Is that an essential component of this?
Yes, that this court enjoys review of whether the state procedural bar was misapplied.
And if we find that the state procedural bar was misapplied, then we undertake de novo review of the particular merits issue.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct, because the merits were never passed upon by the state court. And that's true both in post-conviction and with the corresponding claim in the 26B, which I do submit is the cleaner path to merits review, because we know from Buck that at least a subclaim of this ground 24 would and could have prevailed on direct appeal. If the court has no questions on prejudice, I will not address it, but I did want to point out some of the other linkings in the record that I think are absent from the warden's response. I just want to reiterate that in the opening statement, counsel made linkings between race and dangerousness, that it occurred several times in the context of the testimony of Mr. C, the cultural expert. who talked about the worldview of African American youth as survival by any means necessary, that Mr. Akbar came from a culture of violence. These linkings were not just present in the testimony of Dr. Eisenberg on direct cross-examination. They are peppered throughout the brief, and I would direct you to my principal brief for those examples. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Willett.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Charles L. Willie, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Ohio, arguing for the warden. Your Honors, the two basic issues in this case are, first, did the district court correctly deny relief on the claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel that was presented in the 24th ground of Jones's petition? Now, we emphasize, Your Honors, that it's critical to look at what the claim actually was that was presented in the post-conviction in the petition and not presented properly to the state courts. The claim that was presented, although broadly termed a challenge to the defense's preparation of Dr. Eisenberg, the specific allegations were that as a result of that ineffectiveness, Dr. Eisenberg's testimony conflicted with other testimony presented by the defense and overlooked significant mitigating factors. That was the claim that was made. Why is that important? Because, as we all can see, a claim has two components: the legal basis for relief plus the factual allegations underlying that claim. Notably, there was no claim here that Dr. Eisenberg's testimony was infused with racially prejudiced information. That claim was not made. That claim, of course, would have been based on the record just like the claims that were actually presented. In applying Ohio's res judicata doctrine, it has been Ohio's rule for many years that a claim that is based on the record must be raised on direct appeal, including claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. This court said, accordingly, if a claim is such a claim is raised for the first time in post-conviction, the state courts will hold under Ohio's res judicata doctrine that it's barred from review. This court has upheld that determination many times as an adequate and independent state ground for relief. Now, here, petitioner seems to argue now that, well, the state courts got it wrong because I presented testimony outside the record in the form of differing opinions. But nevertheless, the claim remained the same. The claim remained that counsel's ineffective handling of preparation of Dr. Eisenberg resulted in information that was conflicting and also failed to bring out mitigating evidence. Now, that
actually Eisenberg's testimony actually brought out the opposite. It actually was very harmful to the petitioner. And I mean, the question is, why call Eisenberg to testify at all if it's going to hurt your client? And trial counsel knew what his testimony was, but he certainly didn't have to call him. And by calling him, he made it more likely that the jury was going to find a penalty of death here. I mean, just calling the witness, I think, is just ineffective, isn't it?
Your Honor, that may well be an argument as we sit here today. It may be an argument that could have been presented to the district court. It may be an argument that could have been presented to the state courts, but it wasn't.
What exactly does Ground 24 say? Failing to properly prepare expert witness and to present proper mitigation evidence? I mean, that's all about Eisenberg, isn't it?
Yes and no, Your Honor, because that could cover a vast number of specific failures on the part of preparing and presenting Dr. Eisenberg. It could present a vast number of possibilities.
Okay, how is an argument even made that Eisenberg's testimony helped the petitioner here? How does he even come up with an argument like that?
Well,
tell me what it is, because I don't quite see how anything that he said would have helped Akbar. And tell me how it would.
I will say this, Your Honor, at the outset, direct answer to your question. It's certainly arguable, as the testimony brought out during cross-examination was harmful to.
Well, the direct testimony too, wasn't it? I mean, his whole testimony, everything he said was.
Your Honor,
what actually helped Akbar in the testimony?
Your Honor, was the theme of the defense here.
Okay, I guess I need to know what that is, because
the theme of the defense here was that, owing to the circumstances under which the defendant grew up, was raised. The what he suffered actually as a part of his everyday life was mitigating, in the sense that it was mitigating because, for one, it did support a psychiatric diagnosis of a recognized mental disease or defect, which tended to show that the defendant's actions were less blameworthy because he suffered from the consequences of his environment, and which hurt his ability to act and conform to the law. A counsel could reasonably decide that framing such an argument in the terms of a mental disease or defect has a tendency to show that this is something beyond the control of the defendant. The defendant cannot make choices rationally because of things beyond his control, which in fact amount to causing a mental disease or defect.
But couldn't counsel do that without injecting race? I mean, Buck talks about the racial toxin of this sort of negative testimony about, you know, young black youth. I mean, could have made the same arguments without making what, as near as I can tell, are completely unsupported statements about the percentages of, you know, urban African Americans who, you know, have, you know, this APD, antisocial personality disorder. You know, it's the injecting race as to future dangerousness that really makes this problematic. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would like to point out that, again, this was brought out at first in cross-examination. So, in other words, this was not presented on Dr. Eisenberg's direct testimony. Secondly, there was nothing in Dr. Eisenberg's testimony to indicate in any way that somehow the defendant's race should be considered as a relevant factor in determining his sentence. We have to, this may seem subtle, but I think it's a good point. The race here was also paired repeatedly with urban, with his environment. In other words, his mitigation was that due to his environment, he was given less, had less choices. There was no suggestion here, for example,
was he raised in an urban environment?
Yes.
Mr. Akbar?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And by all accounts, again, the mitigating testimony that was presented by other witnesses followed this theme completely, that, again, he was really the victim in a certain sense of his circumstances, of his upbringing. This is not, of course, an unusual type of mitigation. It's not an unusual theory.
The theory that his condition is incurable, and that therefore he has no prospect for recovery. And the jury's going to say, well, you know, maybe he ought to be sentenced to death since we're worried that he's going to have this for the rest of his life, and he'll be a danger in prison too.
That is Your Honor, you hit the right, that's the other side of, that's a double-edged sword when you present this type of argument. The other edge of the sword is exactly what you said, that perhaps this would indicate that, well, maybe this doesn't, maybe this is militates against life imprisonment. And the defense attempted to address that. The defense did address that in the sense that the defense argued that this is not something that could be expected to occur again, that he was not a threat to murder. That was the defense attempted that was essentially the defense's argument here. He was not, as a matter of fact, Dr. Eisenberg did point out that his very incarceration would, of course, make it less likely that he would be able to act antisocial, if you will, or commit murder.
He would also be a danger in the prison if this was an incurable situation.
That is true, Your Honor. That is correct. And again, that's part of the double edge of that sword, is that I would like to point out too, make this here we have to first look at the prong. There's two prongs of every Strickland claim. And the first prong is, was counsel professionally deficient in choosing Dr. Eisenberg? And if the court, yesterday I did a word search, James Eisenberg, on Ohio's Lexis Federal and State Library. And you will see that Dr. Eisenberg has testified many, many times in capital cases. And particularly, he has testified in favor of petitioners in state post-conviction, attacking the effectiveness of trial counsel's preparation. Secondly, in looking here, the petitioner relies on Buck versus Davis. And that really brings us to the second issue presented in this case. And that is, can those arguments based on Buck versus Davis sustain habeas corpus relief before this court? And we would say, no, Your Honor, this is clear. Those arguments were never properly presented to the state courts, and they were never properly presented to the district court.
Well, weren't they presented in the Rule 26B proceeding in the state court, challenging the failure to raise on direct appeal the racialized evidence issue?
You know, my recollection is no. There was a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel that allegedly was not presented on direct appeal. But my recollection is it didn't include the Buck versus Davis claim.
And it couldn't have mentioned Buck because Buck didn't exist at the time.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. But you see, the racially charged, if this case indeed presents racially charged and prejudicial testimony akin to what was in Buck versus Davis, then one would think that you would not need to have a case from the Supreme Court to raise this question. And indeed, the strongest indication that this testimony did not rise to the type of testimony involved in Buck versus Davis is no one alleged it until Rule 60B.
That just could be that the attorneys you're not effective essentially until then. I guess my question is, you made reference about selecting Dr. Eisenberg, and of course he's got a rich history of, you know, teaching and providing reports and testifying in court. I don't know that it's so much the selection of Dr. Eisenberg, it's the preparation of Dr. Eisenberg and the fact that you have put on a witness, select and prepare a witness, and don't know that he is going to testify, as I understand it, that urban African Americans are 30 times more likely to have this antisocial personality disorder and be more of a danger going forward. That's a question. I mean, it just, you ask how harmful can that be? If I'm a juror and I hear from an expert that urban African Americans, which apparently there's no question that Mr. Akbar is 30 times more likely to be dangerous.
Your Honor,
I don't see how that's not deficient and ultimately perhaps prejudicial.
Your Honor,
it's just a question. I'm not here to argue.
I understand. Yeah. Your question is poignant and well, obviously, right, well taken. But I would ask Your Honor to take a look at the actual testimony that is at issue in this case. The district judge in the Rule 60B opinion carefully set forth what the testimony that was being challenged as compared to what was the testimony in Buck. We naturally, Your Honor, would disagree with our honorable opponent's characterization of that testimony. Essentially, what happened here was the prosecutor in direct examination called for demographic information concerning the frequency of a particular diagnosis, antisocial personality disorder. What the prosecutor perhaps ineptly and perhaps unwisely was attempting to show that because the frequency of this particular diagnosis, it does not lead to persons who have been diagnosed with this mental illness, mental disease, to commit violent murders. The prosecutor was attempting to attack the mitigating aspects of Dr. Eisenberg's testimony. And again, I would say ineptly, invited Dr. Eisenberg to comment on the demographics. Dr. Eisenberg was not saying that African Americans are 30 times more likely to commit murder or 30 times more likely to be antisocial personalities. What Dr. Eisenberg was saying was, as in many, many types of diagnosis, psychiatric or physical, sometimes demographic studies are done, and sometimes some comparisons will be made as to what the frequency of a particular diagnosis is within given groups of population.
Let me ask you this. Everyone seems to be assuming that Mr. Akbar comes from, I don't know, kind of urban, maybe poverty-stricken background. Is that clear in the record? I mean, Ashtabula is pretty much, as I understand it, a rural community. Is it clear that he's from some sort of "quote unquote," urban?
My review of the record indicates yes, that the parties seem to, my reading of the record indicates the parties seem to agree with that proposition.
This would be some, maybe you can point, you probably can't point in the record where that is, but you're talking about a community that's, I mean, I think the whole county might be 20,000 people, or maybe it's the city, that's pretty, you know, agricultural. I don't know it beyond that, but are we just to accept that he's from this urban background? Maybe it doesn't make a difference.
Your Honor, that's a good point. But I think more importantly, it seems as though the testimony in question seemed to be about the link those two things, urban and race. I mean, I think the testimony did link those two concepts.
Yeah. I guess I just can't imagine an attorney presenting an expert, not having prepared that expert to know that there'll be testimony about race, as we have been discussing here. It's just beyond me to see how that can be helpful. And either he prepared the the expert and knew he was going to testify to that, or he just didn't know. Either way, it's pretty bad preparation on part of an attorney.
I would submit, Your Honor, that these are difficult questions, but one thing to keep in mind is that when one is using an expert as a witness, an attorney quite often relies on the expert to anticipate what attacks the expert could expect on his opinions and diagnoses, and also relies on the expert to properly address any types of cross-examination that are presented by the other side.
And Dr. Eisenberg never supported his, this opinion of, 15 to 25 or 30% of urban African Americans having antisocial personality. I mean, he says it, but I didn't see anywhere in the transcript where there's really any support or any challenge by anybody, just sort of this acceptance that that's the case.
Your Honor, I did some, foolishly perhaps, I tried to do some research on this with just general searches, and I could not find anything in terms of, I found one study that referenced demographic studies of antisocial personality diagnosis. There was one study out there where someone undertook to do that, but I could not find anything.
The basic problem here that it was the prosecutor who asked the question, an urban African-American males, probably in the neighborhood of 15 to 25%, maybe even 30% have the APD. And then the problem is that Eisenberg runs with this question that the prosecutor asked. And then the problem is that the defense lawyer runs with this and makes it worse. And then in closing argument, the defense lawyer talks about this again, and the prosecutor talks about this again. So the prosecutor put this in, and Eisenberg blindly says yes. And the next question of the prosecutor, those 30%, or take the percent of urban African males who have this antisocial personality disorder, very, very few of them commit murder. That's true. So then Eisenberg goes off on this 30% tangent.
And Your Honor, my look at this, it's in context. What was happening here was the prosecutor was attempting to, again, undercut the mitigating value of this diagnosis. The prosecutor wasn't suggesting that, he's an antisocial person. Well, that's a good reason to sentence him to death. What he was saying is, even though he was diagnosed with an antisocial personality disorder, that was not a reason. That was not mitigating. That was not a reason to not sentence him to death for his crime.
If I could sort of focus us back on whether or not the procedural default has been addressed here sufficiently. Under our precedent, are we as a court of appeals, federal court of appeals, able to evaluate whether the Ohio Court of Appeals properly applied res judicata?
Your Honor, yes. Under Hill versus Mitchell, the court held that under certain circumstances, a court in federal habeas corpus can conclude that the Ohio Court of Appeals or Ohio court erroneously applied the res judicata doctrine. That is true. However, Your Honor, at the same time, it bears emphasis here that this cause and prejudice argument was not made to the district court. Jones did not say that, my appellate lawyer was ineffective for not raising this issue. He never said that. And so we would submit, Your Honor, that it is difficult to see how the district court's decision can be overturned on appeal for a failure to recognize a cause for a default, which was never presented.
All right, Mr. Willey, I agree with you. The ineffective assistance of appellate counsel was not raised in the district court. However, res judicata was. the yes, argument right. that the Ohio courts improperly applied their res judicata rule, and therefore that is an excuse to overcome procedural default. How do you argue against that? Because that is before us.
I argue that the state court clearly properly applied res judicata. Again, Your Honor, this claim centered on the trial record. It may have expanded dramatically.
How about the new testing that was conducted that wasn't in the trial record?
Your Honor, that would amount to, although there can be subtle differences of opinion here, in essence, what you're talking about is a new, different claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. As I said before, it's one thing to say that counsel was ineffective because his inept handling of an expert witness resulted in particular prejudicial occurrences at trial, like, oh, he could have brought more, he should have emphasized more mitigating evidence, and he put evidence on that was conflicting. It's another thing to say, well, he completely blew it in terms of, I mean, Dr. Eisenberg's opinions and diagnosis were completely wrong. Well, and we can show that. Now, that would be something that would be perhaps another theory of ineffectiveness that might be subject to evidence to horse the record.
So what about the Turner affidavit? Why is that not sufficient to be evidence to horse the record that would allow us to investigate the IAC claim de novo?
Once again, I think as the state court reasonably concluded, if you're essentially relying on something which was in the record or apparent in the record, that you can have another expert render a different opinion based on those facts, then that certainly is not a evidence to horse the record.
But if Turner reevaluated Jones Akbar, if Turner met with him four times and had Jones Akbar undertake various tests, and then Turner based their conclusion on those four interviews and four tests, would that be enough to be evidence to horse the record?
For this particular case, no, because it would dramatically change the claim that was presented. Again, once, you know, in applying res judicata, of course, you first have to look at the precise claim that's presented.
And this claim, if we disagreed with you and said the claim is that broad, would you agree that this is evidence that's outside the record and therefore excuses the procedural default? If we just disagreed with your characterization as to the narrowness of the claim.
I would have to say yes, Your Honor. I would say that okay. if indeed, but I would think that broad characterization of a claim would, I think, result in a number of difficulties. I mean,
sure. No, you answered my question. That's all. And I just may view the claim broader than you. That's all.
And of course here, Your Honor, too, is that it also is important as to how a reasonable court would view the claim. I mean, would the district court here is faced with the claim, and the district court filled in some blanks here. I mean, the district court said, well, he must mean, apparently he's arguing that because the evidence was conflicting and because it maybe was not as, mitigating then he might have presented better mitigating evidence. The district court, that's what the district court was faced with. And the district court was not faced with numerous other arguments in terms of what the results of counsel's ineffectiveness might have been. And again, all the court can do is deal with the claim that was presented. Incidentally, as well, that the district court compared Dr. Eisenberg's testimony and found that actually his testimony was fairly consistent with the testimony of the other expert, again, on the theme of the terrible environment which the defendant suffered through and the terrible individual consequences that he faced in his life. I mean, there were some pretty poignant observations there about his mother committing suicide, his very, very, very poignant mitigating points brought out in the testimony. The key here again is this too. We would think it is well established under Gonzalez versus Crosby that in a context of a Rule 60B motion, the court cannot address the claim. Here, the district court said that this was a proper, in part, 60B motion because it was challenging the court's procedural default holding. The court noted that it could not address the merits of the claim.
Okay, but because it could not, since we have granted a certificate of appealability as to grounds 24, I mean, we can now, right? I mean, we're not limited to the 60B appeal because we've expanded the COA.
Your Honor, I would say that in terms of in granting a certificate of appealability on rule on the grounds 24, the court is to review the district court's decision on the ground that was actually presented in the petition. And that petition
on ground 24 and not necessarily 60B, right?
That's right. And okay. But by the same token, we would point out that there was no argument. While it's true, Buck versus Davis was the legal linchpin of his